A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about those old gas masks the Israeli government distributed years ago. The ones still sitting in apartments across the country, including his own. Nobody knows what to do with them. Apparently you can't just toss them out, or if you do, there's a fee involved. But here's the real question. These things are relics. If they were an actual chemical or biological threat today, are they even the right tool for the job? Why doesn't the government just issue new, better masks? And if you wanted to buy something genuinely protective on the private market, what would that look like? There's a lot to unpack here.
Let's start with how these masks ended up in every Israeli apartment in the first place, because the backstory is fascinating and most people don't know the full arc. The civilian gas mask distribution program began in earnest during the Gulf War in 1991. Iraq had fired Scud missiles at Israel, and there was a very real fear that Saddam Hussein would equip those warheads with chemical agents, sarin, VX, mustard gas. The government distributed masks to the entire population. Every citizen, every resident. It was the first time a country had ever done anything at that scale.
That's the image most people have, right? Sealed rooms, families sitting there in masks, the whole thing. But that was 35 years ago.
And here's the part that surprises people. The program never really ended. After the Gulf War, the government continued manufacturing and distributing masks through the Israel Postal Company. For decades, you could walk into a post office, hand over your ID, and walk out with a box of masks for your entire family. The rationale shifted post-9/11, post-Iraq War, and especially as Syria's chemical weapons program became a major concern. By 2013, when Syria was dismantling its declared chemical arsenal under international pressure, Israel had already refreshed its civilian mask stockpiles multiple times.
The mask sitting in Daniel's apartment, and in millions of other apartments, came through that system. What generation are we talking about?
Most of what's in Israeli homes right now are the M15 or the Shalon mask, which is a locally produced variant based on the German Dräger design. The M15 was the standard civilian model. It's a full-face respirator with a single NATO standard 40mm filter port. The filter itself, and this is the critical part, is an activated charcoal canister designed to adsorb chemical warfare agents. The filters have a finite shelf life. The charcoal degrades, the seals can crack, moisture gets in. After about 10 to 15 years, the filter's effectiveness is compromised. Some of the filters distributed in the early 2000s are now 20-plus years old.
We have an entire country sitting on expired protective equipment, and the government is apparently telling people they can't throw it away. What's the legal situation there?
This is where it gets strange. The masks are technically government property. When you received them, you signed for them. Or at least, your identity was recorded. They're on loan, not a gift. The Ministry of Defense owns those masks, and there have been collection drives over the years where the Homefront Command and the Postal Company set up stations for people to return outdated masks. But compliance is spotty. Millions of masks are unaccounted for. And yes, there's been discussion of fines for improper disposal. The Environmental Protection Ministry has flagged the filters as hazardous waste because of the activated charcoal and the potential chemical residue, even if it's trace amounts. You can't just chuck them in the bin.
Like adopting a feral cat.
Except the cat is government property, it's expired, and disposing of it improperly might get you fined. It's a bureaucratic tangle that nobody quite knows how to resolve. The Homefront Command has run periodic collection campaigns. There was a big one around 2014, another in 2018, and I think there was talk of another push more recently. But the fundamental problem is that the government hasn't issued a comprehensive replacement program. They've done targeted distributions to communities near the borders, the Gaza envelope, the northern communities near Lebanon and Syria, but not a nationwide refresh.
Which brings us to the core of Daniel's question. Why not just issue new, better masks to everyone? If the threat is real enough that you can't throw the old ones away, why is the response so patchwork?
I think there are three reasons, and they're all uncomfortable in different ways. The first is cost. A nationwide mask distribution for roughly 9.5 million people, we're talking about something in the range of 1.5 to 2 billion shekels conservatively. That's a significant line item in a defense budget that's already stretched across a lot of priorities. The second is threat assessment. The intelligence community's current evaluation of the chemical and biological threat from state actors has shifted. Syria's declared chemical weapons were largely destroyed, though there are lingering concerns about undeclared stockpiles. Iran's chemical capabilities exist, but aren't seen as an imminent first-strike threat. Hezbollah has been assessed as potentially having some chemical agents, but delivery systems are a question mark. So the urgency that drove the 1991 distribution isn't there in the same way.
The third reason?
The third reason is the one nobody likes to say out loud. If the government initiated a nationwide mask replacement, it would be read as a signal that an attack is imminent. That kind of move has its own escalatory logic. You don't distribute 9 million masks without the other side noticing and responding. It's a form of deterrent signaling that cuts both ways.
It's a game of chicken played with civilian protective equipment.
It's the reality of living in a neighborhood where chemical weapons have been used in living memory. But let's talk about the masks themselves, because Daniel raised a really good point. Are these old M15 masks even the right tool for the job today? And the honest answer is, it depends on the threat. For classic chemical warfare agents, nerve agents like sarin and VX, blister agents like mustard gas, a well-maintained M15 with a fresh filter is actually still quite effective. The basic physics of filtration hasn't changed dramatically. Activated charcoal with appropriate impregnation, usually copper, silver, zinc, and molybdenum compounds, will adsorb and neutralize those agents.
Well-maintained and fresh filter are doing a lot of work there.
They're doing all the work, and that's the problem. The mask body itself, if it's been stored properly, away from heat and direct sunlight, the rubber or silicone can last quite a while. 20, even 30 years in some cases. But the filters are the weak link. And here's something most people don't realize. Once you open the sealed packaging, the filter starts degrading. The activated charcoal is constantly absorbing whatever's in the air. Humidity, pollutants, volatile organic compounds. Even in a sealed bag, there's some degradation over time. A filter that's been sitting in a closet in Tel Aviv humidity for 15 years is not something I'd want to bet my life on.
What does the private market offer? If someone wanted to take this into their own hands and buy something protective, what are we looking at?
The civilian respirator market has actually evolved significantly in the last decade. The gold standard for combined chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear protection, CBRN, is something like the Avon Protection FM54 or the MSA Millennium. These are full-face masks with dual filter capability, meaning you can change filters without breaking the seal. They use a butyl rubber compound that's more resistant to chemical permeation than the older materials. The FM54, which is used by a lot of NATO militaries, runs about $400 to $500 for the mask alone. Filters are separate. A good CBRN filter can be $40 to $60 each, and you'd want at least two.
These are available to civilians.
In most countries, yes. In Israel, there's a bit of a gray area. The Ministry of Defense regulates the import and sale of protective equipment under the Defense Export Control Law and related regulations. Buying a mask domestically from an authorized supplier is generally fine. Importing one yourself might raise flags. But there are Israeli companies. Shalon, the same company that made the government masks, actually sells upgraded civilian models. Supergum is another Israeli manufacturer. Their civilian CBRN masks run in the $200 to $300 range, which is actually quite competitive with the international options.
For the price of a decent pair of headphones, you can have something that actually works.
But here's where it gets more nuanced. The mask is only one part of the equation. For a genuine chemical or biological threat, you need more than a face seal. Many chemical agents, particularly nerve agents like VX, can be absorbed through the skin. A mask alone won't protect you. You'd need a full protective suit, gloves, over boots. And then there's the training aspect. Putting on a CBRN mask correctly under stress is not intuitive. Military personnel drill this repeatedly. The average civilian who bought a mask and stuck it in a closet? The odds of getting a proper seal in a panic situation are not great.
Which is the argument for the government-issued model, right? Standardized equipment, standardized training, standardized distribution. You don't have to be an expert, you just have to follow the instructions that everyone else is following.
That was always the logic. And it's not wrong. The Homefront Command has done public education campaigns, they've run drills, they've put out videos, but if the masks people actually have in their homes are degraded to the point of being unreliable, that standardization becomes a liability. It creates a false sense of security.
Covering the covers.
And that false sense of security is arguably worse than having no mask at all, because it changes behavior. Someone who thinks they're protected might stay in a contaminated area longer than they should, or might delay evacuation. The Israeli approach has historically been sealed room plus mask, shelter in place. But modern thinking in CBRN defense has shifted more toward evacuation and decontamination. The mask is a tool to buy time, not a long-term solution.
Let's go back to the collection problem, because I think that's the strangest part of this whole thing. The government gave out millions of these masks. They're now expired, and the government doesn't seem to have a clear plan for getting them back. What's actually happening with the collection drives when they do happen?
The collection drives have been sporadic and, frankly, not very effective. The Homefront Command sets up collection points, usually at post offices, sometimes at community centers. People bring in their old masks and filters, they're logged, and the materials are disposed of as hazardous waste. In some campaigns, the collection was tied to reissuing new masks to communities in higher risk areas. But the nationwide coverage hasn't happened. There was reporting in Haaretz a few years back about the logistical nightmare of tracking millions of masks. Some families had moved, some had thrown them out despite the rules, some just didn't bother. The compliance rate for collection drives has historically been around 30-40%. That leaves a lot of masks in the wild.
The hazardous waste angle. What's the actual environmental concern there?
The filters contain activated charcoal impregnated with metal compounds, chromium, copper, sometimes silver. If these end up in landfills, there's a risk of those metals leaching into groundwater. The quantities per filter are small, but multiply by millions of filters, and it becomes a real regulatory issue. The Environmental Protection Ministry classified them as hazardous waste, specifically to prevent mass dumping. But enforcement is basically impossible. Nobody's going through your trash to check for gas mask filters.
You have a policy that's unenforceable, equipment that's degraded, and a population that's largely checked out of the whole thing. What would a sensible replacement program actually look like?
If I were designing it from scratch, I'd look at what Switzerland does. Switzerland has a very different threat profile, but their civil protection model is instructive. Every Swiss household is required by law to have a shelter. It's in the building code. They also maintain a system where protective equipment is stored in communal shelters rather than individual homes. The equipment is inspected and rotated on a schedule. It's a collective model rather than an individual one. For Israel, you could imagine something similar. Neighborhood-level caches of modern CBRN equipment, maintained by the Homefront Command, with regular inspection cycles. It would solve the storage degradation problem and the collection problem simultaneously.
That assumes people can get to the neighborhood cache during an attack, which might not be the case if the warning time is short.
That's the trade-off. The individual model gives you immediate access but terrible maintenance. The collective model gives you good maintenance but a time delay. There's no perfect solution. Some countries, South Korea for example, do a hybrid. They issue masks to individuals in high-threat areas and maintain communal stockpiles for the broader population. South Korea's program is interesting because their threat is also from a hostile neighbor with chemical weapons capability. They've distributed masks to something like 60% of the population, but the masks are simpler, often just a hood-style escape respirator rather than a full military-spec mask.
An escape hood? That's a different philosophy entirely.
An escape hood is designed for one thing, get you out of the contaminated area alive. It doesn't need to work for hours, it doesn't need to interface with a suit, it doesn't need to let you operate equipment. You pull it on, you leave, you discard it. They're cheaper, $50 to $100, and they're simpler to use. The seal doesn't have to be perfect, just good enough for 15 to 30 minutes. For a civilian population, that might actually be a more realistic tool than a full-face military respirator.
Which circles back to Daniel's question about buying privately. If you're going to spend your own money on this, are you better off with a $400 full-face mask or the $50 escape hood?
It depends entirely on your threat model. If you're worried about a chemical attack while you're at home, and the Homefront Command's instruction is to shelter in place, which has historically been the Israeli protocol, then you want the full face mask with a proper seal and a filter that can handle extended exposure. If you're worried about an attack while you're out and your plan is to get away from the area as fast as possible, the escape hood is probably the more practical choice. It's lighter, it's faster to don, and you're not going to be fumbling with straps and fit checks while running.
For biological threats specifically.
Biological is a different beast. Most biological agents, anthrax spores for example, are particulates. You don't need the activated charcoal for chemical adsorption, you need a high-efficiency particulate filter. An N95 or N100 filter will handle most biological threats. The full face mask is overkill for purely biological protection, but it does offer the advantage of protecting your eyes, which is relevant for some agents. The escape hood typically has a lower filtration efficiency, but enough for a short exposure. For a long-duration biological event, a persistent aerosol, say, you'd want a powered air-purifying respirator, a PAPR, which uses a battery-powered blower to push air through the filter. Those run over $1,000 and are not something most civilians are going to have sitting around.
Let's talk about the Israeli manufacturing angle, because you mentioned Shalon and Supergum. These are companies that actually know what they're doing. Why isn't there a government program to just buy new masks from them and do a clean swap? Turn in your old one. Get a new one.
Shalon is actually a fascinating company. They were founded in the 1960s, originally as a rubber products manufacturer. They've been making masks for the IDF and for the civilian program for decades. Their civilian models today are significantly better than the M15. Better field of vision, better speech diaphragm so you can actually communicate, more comfortable materials. Supergum is another Israeli manufacturer with a strong reputation. They make the rubber components for a lot of military masks, including some that are exported. The industrial capacity is there. The question is purely political and budgetary.
The political calculus is that spending 2 billion shekels on masks signals something you don't want to signal.
And there's also the question of prioritization. The defense establishment has to weigh mask distribution against Iron Dome batteries, against underground hospital construction, against cyber defense, against 100 other things. In a world of finite budgets, the mask refresh keeps getting pushed down the list. The calculation seems to be that the probability of a large-scale chemical attack is low enough that the current patchwork approach, masks for border communities, collection drives for the rest, is acceptable. Whether that calculation is correct is above my pay grade, but it's the calculation that's being made.
There's also a psychological dimension here that I think is worth exploring. These masks are in people's homes. They're a physical reminder of the threat. You see that box in your closet, and on some level, you know it's there for a reason. If the government came and took them away without replacing them, that might actually increase anxiety. If they replace them with new ones, that might also increase anxiety. The mask in the closet is almost a talisman at this point.
That's a really sharp observation. The mask is a symbol as much as it is a tool. It says, we are prepared and also we are under threat simultaneously. Getting rid of it feels like tempting fate. Keeping it feels like living in a state of siege. And the government's ambivalence about collection and replacement mirrors the population's ambivalence about the whole situation. Nobody wants to think about chemical weapons, but nobody wants to be unprotected either.
The mask sits there, but somehow impossible to discard. It's the gas mask of Schrödinger, simultaneously protective and not, owned and borrowed, necessary and irrelevant.
That's the Israeli condition in one household object. But let me bring some practical specifics to this, because I think listeners who have these masks should know what to actually look for. If you have an M15 or a Shalon mask in your home, the first thing to check is the manufacturing date, which should be stamped on the mask body and on the filter packaging. If the filter is older than 10 years, it should be considered expired, even if it's still sealed. The mask body, check for cracking, especially around the seal and the straps. Rubber that's gone stiff or shows visible cracking should not be trusted. If you have a mask from the original 1991 distribution, that's 35 years old. Do not rely on it.
If someone wants to buy a private market replacement today, what should they look for?
A few key things. First, make sure the mask is certified to a recognized standard. NIOSH in the US, CE in Europe, or the Israeli standards. look for a CBRN rating specifically, not just an industrial respirator. Industrial masks are designed for particulates and vapors at low concentrations, not for chemical warfare agents at the concentrations you'd see in an attack. Second, fit is critical. A mask that doesn't seal properly is worse than useless. It gives you false confidence. If you can, get fit tested. Some suppliers offer this. At minimum, do a negative pressure test, cover the filter ports with your palms, inhale gently, and the mask should collapse slightly against your face and hold the vacuum. If air leaks in around the seal, adjust the straps or try a different size.
The filter situation.
For chemical threats, you want a CBRN filter, typically labeled as an ABEK filter with an additional particulate rating. ABEK stands for the four classes of gases and vapors it handles. The filter should be NATO standard 40mm threading, which is what most military and high-end civilian masks use. Keep filters sealed until needed. Once opened, they're good for about 6 months in normal use, less in high humidity. Store them in a cool, dry place. And understand that no filter handles everything. Carbon monoxide, for example, requires a different type of filter entirely. Ammonia requires specific impregnation. There's no universal filter.
The private market solution is, spend a few $100s on a mask, spend more on filters, get fit tested if possible, store everything properly, and accept that, even then, you're not covered for every scenario.
That's the reality. And this is why the government program existed in the first place, because doing this at an individual level is expensive, complicated, and error-prone. The government could do it at scale, with standardization and quality control. The tragedy is that the program has atrophied to the point where the private market is arguably the better option for someone who's serious about protection. Not because private equipment is inherently better, but because it's not 20 years old.
I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier, the sealed room protocol. That was the big thing in 91. Everyone had their sealed room, plastic sheeting over the windows, tape around the doors, and the mask was part of that system. Is that still the protocol today?
The sealed room concept has evolved. During the Gulf War, the concern was primarily chemical agents delivered by ballistic missiles, scuds with potential chemical warheads. The sealed room was designed to keep the agent out while you waited for the all clear. Today, the threat landscape includes shorter range rockets from Hezbollah and Hamas, which could potentially carry chemical payloads, though that's never been confirmed. The Homefront Command's current guidance varies by scenario. For a confirmed chemical attack, shelter in place with a sealed room and mask is still the baseline. For biological, the guidance is more nuanced. It depends on the agent, the delivery method, and whether it's contagious. But the app. The Homefront Command app now pushes real-time instructions based on the specific event, so the protocol is more dynamic than it was in the 90s.
Which means the mask is still relevant, but it's part of a larger system that includes real-time information, sealed spaces, and probably a lot of other things that the average person hasn't thought about since the last drill.
That's the gap, isn't it? The mask is the visible artifact of a preparedness system that most people have disengaged from. The drills happen less frequently than they used to. The public consciousness has shifted to other threats, rockets, tunnels, cyber. Chemical and biological have faded into the background, but the capabilities haven't gone away. Syria's chemical weapons program was declared dismantled, but the OPCW, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, has documented ongoing use of chemical agents in the Syrian civil war as recently as 2018 and 2019. These aren't hypotheticals. They were used in the last decade. Iran's chemical weapons program is less documented than its nuclear and missile programs, but the U.S. intelligence community has assessed that Iran maintains a chemical weapons capability, primarily as a deterrent. They have the industrial base to produce nerve agents and blister agents. They've never used them in combat, as far as we know, but the capability exists. Hezbollah, as Iran's proxy, is the more immediate concern for Israel. There have been assessments, I've seen them referenced in think tank reports, that Hezbollah may have acquired chemical weapons or the precursors to produce them. The evidence is circumstantial, but it's enough that Israeli defense planners take it seriously.
The threat is real, the masks are expired, and the government is stuck in a signaling dilemma. That's the summary, isn't it?
That's about the size of it, but I want to add one more piece that doesn't get talked about much. The Homefront Command has actually been building a different kind of capability, a medical countermeasure stockpile. Atropine auto-injectors for nerve agent exposure, for example. These are preloaded syringes that can be self-administered or given by a family member. They're distributed to first responders and stored in strategic caches. The idea is that even if the mask fails or the exposure happens before you can don it, there's a pharmaceutical backup. It's not a replacement for the mask, but it's part of the layered defense.
Which is a more sophisticated approach than just, here's a mask, good luck.
Modern CBRN defense is about layers. Detection, warning, physical protection, medical countermeasures, decontamination, evacuation. The mask is just one layer. The problem is that for civilians, the mask is the only layer they can see and touch. Everything else is invisible until it's needed, and that creates a distorted picture of preparedness.
Let's talk about the collection problem one more time, because I think there's a practical question here that a lot of listeners are probably wondering. If you have one of these masks in your home right now, what should you actually do with it?
Check if there's an active collection drive. The Homefront Command and the Postal Company announce these periodically. If there is one, take it in. If there isn't, the official guidance has been to hold on to it until the next collection drive. I know that's unsatisfying, but that's the official line. Unofficially, I'd say, if the mask is more than 15 years old, it's not providing meaningful protection. You're keeping a box of expired government property that's taking up space and giving you a false sense of security. At some point, the rational thing is to accept that the government's collection program is broken and make your own decision about disposal. The hazardous waste concern is real, but one mask in a landfill is not an environmental catastrophe. It's the aggregate that matters, and that's the government's problem to solve through proper collection, not the individuals.
That's going to be a controversial take.
It's not official advice. It's just me saying that a policy that expects millions of people to store expired equipment indefinitely with no clear end date is not a serious policy. If the government wants the masks back, they need to make it easy and they need to do it consistently. Until then, people are going to make their own choices.
If someone wants to replace their government mask with a private purchase, we've covered the basics. But I'm curious about one thing. Are there any Israeli startups or newer companies doing interesting things in this space? It seems like the kind of problem that would attract innovation.
There are a few. One that caught my attention is a company called SaverOne. Not directly mask-related, but they're doing sensor systems for detection. Another area of innovation is in mask materials. There's research coming out of the Technion on graphene-based filters that could be more effective and have longer shelf lives than traditional activated charcoal. Graphene oxide membranes can be engineered to selectively filter specific molecules, which could theoretically allow for a filter that's tailored to specific threat agents rather than the broad-spectrum approach of charcoal. It's still lab stage, but it's promising.
The next generation of civilian protection might look quite different from the M15.
But we're not there yet, and the gap between lab innovation and mass deployment is measured in years, sometimes decades. In the meantime, the best option for someone who's serious about this is probably the current generation of CBRN masks from established manufacturers, Chelond, Supergum, Avon, MSA, paired with fresh filters and proper storage.
It strikes me that there's a broader lesson here about government preparedness programs in general. You can't just distribute equipment and walk away. There has to be a life cycle plan. Maintenance, replacement, disposal, training. Without that, the equipment becomes a liability.
And it's not unique to gas masks. I've seen the same pattern with other civil defense programs around the world. Fallout shelters that haven't been inspected in decades. Emergency supply caches with expired food and water. The initial investment gets made, there's a press conference, everyone feels good, and then attention moves on. But preparedness is a process, not a purchase. It requires ongoing commitment and ongoing funding. The Israeli gas mask program is a case study in what happens when you make the purchase but don't sustain the process.
The masks just sit there, quietly expiring, while the threat evolves and the population forgets why they had them in the first place.
It's almost poetic, in a bleak sort of way. A whole country's worth of good intentions, slowly degrading in the back of closets.
All right, let's bring this home. For the listener who has one of these masks and wants to take action, check the date, check the condition, look for a collection drive. If you want to buy privately, look for CBRN certification, get a proper fit, store your filters correctly, and understand the limits of what you're buying. And maybe, this is me, not official advice. Don't lose sleep over whether the government is going to fine you for throwing out a 30-year-old mask.
That's a fair summary. The one thing I'd add is that the best piece of protective equipment is information. Know what the threats are, know what the protocols are, have the Homefront Command app on your phone. The mask is a tool. Knowing when and how to use it, or when not to, is what actually keeps you safe.
If the government ever does get around to a nationwide replacement program, we'll be the first to talk about it. And now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the 1950s, linguists mistakenly attributed a polysynthetic morphological pattern found in Inuktitut to the Itelmen language of Kamchatka. The error arose when a field researcher's notebooks were mislabeled during transit from the Soviet Union to a Danish university archive. The misattribution persisted in comparative linguistics literature for nearly two decades before a graduate student noticed that the cited structures bore no resemblance to any documented Itelmen speech and traced the error back to the original shipping manifest.
There's a graduate student out there who peeked in the archives and has been chasing that high ever since.
The shipping manifest. Of course it was the shipping manifest. This has been My Weird Prompts, produced by Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. If you've got a gas mask in your closet and a story about it, we'd love to hear it. Leave us a review and tell us about it.
We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.